Okay, then in the second part, done by Michael, we will look at the constraints imposed by neutrality. We want to build some bulk quark matter. So now, to begin with, we'll shortly remind you of what we are dealing with. We have cold, dense, strongly interacting matter, and we know there is some attractive interaction that Fermi surface is unstable against a pair condensation. And in contrast to QED, where we need phonons to produce this attractive interaction, in QCD, already the perturbative one-gluon exchange provides us with an attractive interaction. So now it's probable that also at intermediate densities, these perturbative calculations are not applicable. There is some attractive interaction which favors the pair condensation in some channel. And it turns out that there are many channels possible, not forbidden by Pauli principle or by symmetry, but it turns out that the most important example is this one shown here in the color anti-triplet channel. The C bar here is a quark field with a spin, color, and flavor index. And here we have the interaction in the Dirac space, in flavor space, and in color space. And the interaction in color and flavor space can be any anti-symmetric SU-free matrix. Means we have altogether 9 different condensates, but it turns out that they are not all independent if one looks at the symmetries. Now, first of all, let us look at 2 idealized cases. The first one is if one looks at a strange quark mass which goes to infinity, then only up the light quarks up and down can condense. And looks at the symmetry properties in color space, one can choose, or first of all, there are only condensation is only possible if the flavor index J here is equal to 2. And then one can look at the symmetry properties in color space, see that it's possible to choose only the delta 2, 2, non-zero. That means in that case, only 2 out of the 3 quark colors are gapped. And this means the color SU3 is broken down to SU2. In this case, all chiral symmetry is restored. The other limiting case is if we look at degenerate masses for the 3 quark flavors. I should say that the quantity which decides whether pairing is possible or not is not really the masses, but the Fermi momenta. But that we will discuss later. Here, and in this case, we will have a condensation between all these 3 quark flavors. And it turns out that the most favored state in this case is the one where we have equal condensation for this delta 2, 2, 5, 5, and 7, 7. This is the so-called color flavor locked state, where the rotations in color space are locked to that in flavor space. And in this case, the chiral symmetry is broken. So now, these are 2 idealized cases, and the reality lies somewhere in between. Means we have some strange quark mass, which is neither infinite nor degenerate with the 2 other flavors. So the question is, which condensation pattern does occur? In the first step, we will look at 1 common chemical potential for all the quark flavors. Now, if the strange quark mass is of the order, the same order of magnitude as the chemical potential, then the Fermi momentum of the up quark, which is, if we neglect the mass, it's almost the chemical potential, is much larger than the Fermi momentum of the strange quark. Means in this case, we would guess that there's only condensation between light quark flavors. But if the chemical potential is much larger than the mass, then we could neglect it. And we see that the Fermi momenta are almost equal. That means in this case, we would have a CFL phase. And there's one important point, that not only the masses have some influence on the phases, but also the phases could influence the masses. And we have done their model calculation in some NJL type model, where the masses are related to this quark antiquark condensates. And these are determined self-consistently together with the quark quark condensates. And down here you can see the results for the masses and for the condensates as a function of the chemical potential. And here you can see two distinct phase transitions. One to the 2SC phase, there only the delta 2,2 is non-zero. That means the condensate which pairs light quarks. And here you also have a pairing between light and strange quarks. And for the masses, you see that here for the transition from the 2SC phase.
Yeah.
Okay, then this one here is the mass of the light quarks here, and the strange quark is up here, and this line is mass of the strange quark.
These are the
quark masses.
The twin masses.
Considered masses.
Yeah.
But there are actually masses, right?
No.
No. We have some small current mass.
So that's what we see in between around 400
here.
Is the small mass.
Yeah. It's not really the current quark mass because the quark anti-quark condensate does not vanish completely, but it's small. Yeah. And
actually, you can see that at the second phase transition to the CFL phase, it even goes up a little bit again.
Yeah, but it's
here, side.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's a small effect here. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's 100%.
Yeah, okay, it's from 10 to 20. So, so and here, but you can see that the effect for the strange quark mass is much larger here from the transition from the 2SC phase to the CFL phase. That it drops by about 30%.
So, how, I mean, if you play with parameters in the model, how much can you say, for just to pick one example, the strange quark mass in the 2SC phase, how much can you move it up and down?
So this depends on the, we have some parameter for a flavor mixing interaction, this TOF determinant. And in fact, if we turn on this parameter for this flavor mixing interaction being zero, we would have the strange quark mass completely unaffected in the 2SC phase. And if we turn this parameter on, we
try and leave it ajar. I think it must have closed.
We drop the strange quark mass, and this picture is some parameter which is where this the strength of this flavor mixing interaction is already at the it's larger than a value with which you can fit meson masses in the vacuum.
But I guess I'm just curious. So for all the way out to for the left hand 2/3 of the 2SC phase, the strange quark mass is bigger than mu.
Yes,
which means that there are no strange quarks. Correct?
Yeah, and you can see here this going down. It's the density of strange quarks.
What is the strange quark mass?
Well, 400. You see it there. This is 400. 10 or whatever.
Yeah, but this is a plus 5.
This is the constituents. So yeah. What I'm wondering is how much, what would you have to do to the parameters to make it so that already at the onset, at the beginning of the 2SC phase, you have strange quarks present? Is that, I mean, you have to do something brutal, or you just have to turn the parameter up a little bit?
I think you should do something brutal. Because this is already some value which is already too large for this.
I mean, of course you never know.
Yeah, but
the normal starting point is that you take some parameters which have been fitted in vacuum to some meson masses, and you don't really know whether they still have it here. But this is in here, the TOF term is already almost twice as strong as you get it from this fit.
Mm-hmm. What do this quark masses really mean physically? I mean, when they change, does it mean that in this dense medium that the correlation then change?
what are these four muscles?
Well, in an NGL model, there are, I mean, there's no confined in an NGL model, so there are actually masses of.
Yeah, but then they are the masses of the QCD. I mean, they are constant, they don't change with the, I mean, now you
say they're constituent quark masses.
Yeah, but still you.
If you multiply it by 2, you get
I mean, masses. In some kernel model, the masses, they determine the masses of pions or something like that. Now you put the system in a finite density, then what does it mean that the mass is?
Yeah, I think it basically has the same meaning. So if you.
So you mean that the correlation length of pions would correspond to the change?
Well, of course, pions are always special because they are Goldstone bosons. And
but they are not if there is an mu, which is not true.
But the mu is very small.
Okay, but then there is some kelion or something. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you okay, if you are in the very left of all this, where you don't have Dyckhoff condensation, of course there the model is most unphysical, I would say, because you have unconfined constituent forms. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I mean there you have the usual features that you have Goldstone bosons are almost Goldstone bosons, but if you calculate the wrong meson, for instance, this would be something like 2 times these masses.
If you multiply, it's a little bit below 400, it's 350 or something.
Right, twice that would be the wrong
meson. Twice that would be the wrong meson. 3 times that would be a little bit.
Okay, so but more precisely, so this means sort of inverse correlation length of some quantity in a horizontal direction.
Yeah. If you like. It'll come back. Oh, yes, I know what I was going to ask. When you put the Tupped interaction in, depending on how you Fiertz it can look like U bar a product U bar U D bar D S bar S, or it can look like say S bar S and then U D U bar D bar. So I'm just wondering whether you include both.
No, we have only this U bar U D bar D S bar S for the Tupped term.
There's another effect, which is that. There's an effect missing, which is that in the 2SC phase, you have a UD condensate and a U-bar D-bar condensate.
Yeah.
And that should feed back in through the Tupped interaction and generate for you some S-bar S.
Of course.
Yeah.
And so that's not included.
That's not included.
It's not included. Included. So you don't include all diagrams. It doesn't matter how you write a Lagrangian. It's equivalent in which form you write. But each time you write a gap equation, you include all diagrams. All possible diagrams.
Right, so that's what I'm asking whether you did.
So you didn't include some diagrams?
Well, okay, you start from something which is already supposed to be used on Hartree level. So,
because it's always ambiguous, because you can always write it in different forms.
Yeah. No, fine, okay, so of course, we would certainly say to us we should start from instantons and
no. You start from Lagrangian and write by final rules, all diagrams.
Start from a Lagrangian by the fork with a 6-point interaction in it.
Right.
And then write
all diagrams with this Lagrangian reduced them, so.
Okay, but to a given loop order, of course. So you have to stop at some point anyway.
Yeah.
And so
well, I'll say it another way, which is the same as what Edward just said, which is if you take some variational ansatz for the fermion wave function and evaluate the expectation value of your Tupped interaction. Regardless of how you write the Tupped interaction, by taking that expectation value, you'll pick up one term which looks like U bar U D bar D S bar S, and another term which looks like U D, what I said, the other one. You'll have both present.
You have to.
What's that?
You have to write all and then minimize the energy.
Yeah. I think so.
So.
Yeah, I still think this is more just some phenomenological starting point. And so as long as you don't really say this is the interaction, I'm not quite convinced whether I should do that. But, okay, so it's an interesting effect already.
And the effect of that would actually be that if you then, you would get the same value of the strange quark mass for a smaller value of your Tupped coefficient.
Okay.
Yeah. So then, in this case, it would perhaps be possible to have strange quarks already there. So
you have two constants. You have now root term and Tupped term.
Right.
Yeah.
The two coefficients, which you feed to some masses.
Yeah.
in fact, we are free because we have this for one for the quark anti-quark and then quark quark. Yeah.
Not really.
So.
Probably you can create them,
sure. Yeah, then you can again the question if you start from something definite, of course you can fit it and can relate them. Well, this is also what we basically did in order to constrain the parameters.
If you start with instance, you can run that.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Continue
so, I think then the second step would be to consider different chemical potentials, which you would.
Now we go from Michaela to Michael.
Just one very naive question. If you have this MJL model without, without mu, then there is a critical coupling about the critical coupling you have bions and chaos and whatnot. If you now put on the mu and you make it bigger and bigger, is this coupling going down? And are the Goldstone bubbles going down? Or what happens really?
There would be critical chemical tensions.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear the question.
There's critical chemical potential. And above that chemical potential, then there's no critical coupling because
Finger
pairing happens for.
Okay.
In KGL model, actually, there is no even strictly speaking critical coupling as soon as you have any chemical potential.
Any chemical?
Yeah, if you have just one interaction, attractive interaction.
Not if there's a mass, though.
Not if there is a mass.
If there is a mass,
create
a
mass.
Okay, so the next step will be more in the sense of a discussion, I guess. Because recently there was this paper by Krishna and Mark Alford claiming that this 2SC phase might not exist in a compact SAS simply because there are additional constraints, which we so far have not looked at in the calculations Michaela presented. And of course, the constraints are that in a neutron star, first of all, this is a static object which lives a very long time, so you have beta equilibrium. Then on at least some macroscopic scale, it has to be charge neutral. And also it should be a color singlet. And in order to be a color singlet, a necessary condition will be that it has to be color neutral. So one has to put all these constraints now into account. And in principle, that means there's not one mu, but you have to choose several mus, both in flavor and color, in order to fulfill these things. And of course, this makes the calculation much more complicated. And so
Mark and I cheated in all sorts of different ways. They're trying to do it right. We cheated.
Will you explain all the cheating?
No.
Well, maybe.
That's the point.
I'm not sure whether we find it. So
exactly.
So anyway, so I think at least we claim that color neutrality is a less important constraint here. I mean, it is of course important to have color neutrality, but it will not change so much. This is our opinion. And what we show here is some older calculation, which we have done some time ago in a different context. Unfortunately, again, the colors are missing. So what is plotted on the left-hand side are densities. And so we have, in this case, we have a 2SC, so a two-flavor color superconductor, where the red and the green quarks are gapped and the blue quark does not participate there. And if you then just calculate the densities within some model as a function of mu, then you find, I have to tell you, that the density of the gapped quarks is somewhat larger than the density of the ungapped quark. So this is just what you get. Now, of course, then you can try to correct for that just by including an additional chemical potential in such a way that they all have the same density. And what is plotted here now in this plot is now the energy per particle, energy per quark as a function of density. And so the lower curve, which is with a lower energy, corresponds now to the case that you have equal chemical potentials, and that means unequal densities. And the upper one is corresponds to the case that by hand we have chosen the chemical potentials such that the densities are the same. And the result is, okay, so this costs you some energy, but not very much. So here in this model calculation, we got something less than 1 MeV. So probably this is not a big effect. So therefore, we think which is more important to look at is now the other thing, which was charge neutrality and beta equilibrium. So here I shortly remind you what we have to do. So beta equilibrium means we have these processes that the d quarks and the s quarks can decay into u plus electrons and neutrinos, but the neutrinos can leave the neutron star, so we don't need to care about them. And this simply means that now the chemical potentials of these four species are related in such a way that you basically have two independent chemical potentials, which are related to baryon number conservation and to charge, electric charge conservation. And now in addition, you have charge neutrality, and this tells you then that two-thirds of the up densities minus one-third of down and S minus the electron density, that should be altogether zero. And this gives you another constraint. So in the end, basically, there's only one independent parameter, which is the total density, which you can vary. Now, the first point one has to realize is that the electrons don't really help to give you charge neutrality because there are basically no electrons. This you can estimate in a simple way. So suppose you have massless up and down quarks, and we have very heavy strange quarks at the moment, so there are no strange quarks, and we forget about pairing now. And now we assume that the density of electrons is more or less zero. Then, of course, charge neutrality means that you need twice as many down quarks as up quarks, and that means that the chemical potential for the up for the down quarks is the third root of 2 times the chemical potential for the up quarks. And then you can use this relation to calculate the chemical potential for the electrons, and then you can finally calculate the density of the electrons, and you find that this is about 0.5% of the density of u quarks. Now you can go on and correct for that, and then you will find that, of course, so this means there are some electrons, so this assumption is not completely correct. So that means there are somewhat less down quarks, and so in the end you will find that there are even less electrons. So this is just the upper limit. So for just our qualitative arguing here, we can basically forget about electrons. Also, when you include strange quarks, of course, they are also negative, so this will also reduce the number of electrons. And this is...
So you can forget about Me, but you better be careful about forgetting about mu E, since
right,
mu is only one
right,
quarter.
Right, right. That's right, exactly. So I just say that just for arguing, yes. It's much easier to
so
just forget...
You're going to keep mu E?
Yes.
Okay.
But in principle, those electrons could have very important physical properties.
Sure, sure. No doubt. I mean, this is really just, if we want to put the constraint of charge neutrality, we don't need to think about the electrons. That's all I want to say. And so this is also some older calculation, which we did sometime in an NGL model. And so here you see, again, the behavior of the constituent quark masses for strange up and down, but now with for this charge neutral beta equilibrated medium, which behaves in some way, so similar to what we have seen before. And here are the fractions now of the different species. And in fact, if this was a color transparency, then there would be a purple curve here somewhere, which was the electrons. And if you look into the paper, you see them, if you really look very carefully. So there are indeed electrons, but basically what you see here is that the fraction of the up and down quarks is just here in the low behavior, as we said, in the low regime, just as we said before, that you have twice as many up quarks and down quarks, and then at some densities the strange quarks come in, and of course they help then the down quarks to fulfill this charge neutrality, and So that means the number of down quarks goes down in the same way as the number of strange quarks goes up.
I can, the essence of what Mark and I said, although we said a little more than what I'm going to say, is, so if you look to the far right of this plot, you can see uptown and strange all coming together.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly there, CFL will be favored. And you go rightward, right enough, up, down, and strange come together. Now imagine moving back leftward, and what you see is down, up, and strange are splitting symmetrically.
Yeah.
And so, okay, so you get to some place where CFL is not favored anymore. And the question, which we tried to answer, is once CFL is no longer favored, is the right answer 2FC, which means the up and downs pair, or is it no pairing at all?
Exactly.
And what we found is that at the point where CFL breaks, the up and down are already far, when you go to this, look on this plot, and see, ask where does CFL end, the up and down are already far enough apart that you don't get 2FC pair.
There's actually one difference. I think I will come to that to what you did because
there should be many differences.
Well, of course, yeah. But one point is that you did a Taylor expansion in MS, and so basically this symmetric splitting was for the Fermi momenta, whereas this is for the densities, and so of course densities is something like Fermi momentum cubed, so it is not exactly for the. I mean, here it is, of course, not no longer for the Fermi moment.
Yeah, we assumed MS was small compared to mu. That was how we organized our calculations, and we apologize. That's how we cheated. I mean, we apologize at many points that we know that in reality MS is not small compared to mu, and we also know that MS is not independent of mu. But that's so our two cheats were assuming that MS was independent of mu and small compared to mu.
Yeah. So we now start just with the opposite case that we say MS is large. So again, then there would be no strange quarks. And as we've seen before already, then we have basically twice as many down quarks as up quarks. And this means for the mu that you have this factor root of 2, which is something like 5/4 if you put it on the calculator. And then if you... Well, this makes things sometimes easier. So then if you look into the literature, you find some stability criterions, whether now this pairing can take place. And so I don't know. I'm always confused about which one is the right one to apply. But actually, so I found this one in Raja Gopal and Wilczek, which says that in order that pairing is possible. Of course, so far we discussed just neglecting pairing, and so we assumed that there is really a Fermi surface, which is of course now smeared out once you have a gap. And then there are stability criterions which tell you if the gap is larger than, in this case, square root of 2 times the difference of the chemical potentials, then this pairing is still possible. And so now you can plug in some numbers and say, okay, if mu is equal to 400 MeV, then according to this formula, this one should. I thought we corrected this. Oh, okay. Okay. So this one is mu, and this one is mu d. So you get something like 500 MeV, and then the delta should be, if this is correct, larger than 140 MeV. And already here you can say something because. Okay, this delta is pretty large, or it is something in the order which we got before. But of course, if now the Fermi surfaces start to depart, this delta will probably go down. So it is already unlikely that you will find such a delta there. The second thing is that in our calculations, since this should be mu d, then this is also mu s, and at this chemical potential, there are probably already strange quarks. So this goes also into this direction that. You have already a CFL phase there. So in the literature, there was some analysis by Paolo Bedak who looked at...
Just one comment on the criterion. When you do the full NJL calculation, you shouldn't need to take the criterion.
No, we just look what comes out. Actually, she started running a job, but unfortunately, it was not ready till this discussion session. So. Well, I think she found some solution, but okay, we are not
one point.
Okay.
So this is hot off the presses.
Yeah. Yeah. So we prefer to take something from the literature. And for some reasons, Bedak plotted here the difference nu minus nd, but of course it should be symmetric in that sense. So basically, if you think this is nd minus nu divided by nd plus nu, then by our choice of that nd is twice nu, this number should be 1/3. And so you are somewhere here. And then Bedak predicts in his calculation, where you have only two flavors, that obviously the normal 2SC phase is not stable anymore. But of course, you can always break up the system in such a way that you have a mixed phase of the normal and superconductor. And he predicts this, which already goes into the direction of a crystal, I would say. So, well, I mean, a mixed phase is a very simple poor man's crystal, right? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So this was this case where the strange quark mass is large. For the other case, we now have this Alford Rajagopal calculation. So in this case, if MS is small, you can make a Taylor expansion, and then these guys found that this just mentioned equal splitting of the Fermi momenta. So you have the down Fermi momenta, which is the up Fermi momentum plus something proportional to the strange quark mass squared. And the strange quark Fermi momenta is up minus the same thing. So which already means there's some equal probability for UD and US pairing. So already on this point, you don't really see why UD now should be favored. But of course, at some point, this formula does not work anymore, as we mentioned before. And then this difference will be somewhat larger than that one. OK, and that are now the calculations of your paper. So I hope I explained it correctly. So the left case was now that you simply assume a fixed value of MS and compare now the difference of the free energy which you get compared to a case where you don't have any pairing. So this new is the case where you have no pairing. And so this is now plotted as a function of the gap. And what is found in this case is, if you are at very low, if the gap is small, then the most favored case is that you have no pairing at all. And if you then go to higher gaps, then the result is that, so this dotted line is the 2SC phase, and the 2SC phase at some point becomes more favored than no pairing at all, but at the same point, the CFL becomes even more favored. So now this looks, of course, somewhat unstable, and you don't know what happens if you...
it looks fragile.
Exactly. So... the intermediate or this one?
This one.
This one was pairing where you have UD plus US pairing.
But no DS.
Yeah. Because, I mean, since the Fermi momenta are equally separated, you might think that this one could also be a possibility. But it turns out that it is not. I mean, do you know why? I mean, this is strange.
I actually want to think more about that thing. I mean, even though we said it's not favored, I want to think more about it because, well, it's sort of amusing to think about. But.
Yeah. Because, yeah, okay. At some points, I remember we just played also with this phase, but for massless, for massless strange quarks, where it is, of course, not favored. And, I mean, there it was just as you think. Maybe it corresponds now simply to this corner or even further, that CFL is most favored and 2SC is less favored, and this one is in between. This we found somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what I was expecting also.
Yeah. So for massless strange quarks, this is what comes out. Okay. Now, what they did here is that they put by hand now some non-constant strange quark mass. So as we have seen in Michaela's part, at the phase transition from the how did you, I see, okay. So for the 2SC, you just took the same curve as you had before, right? Okay, and at the phase transition from the 2SC to the color flavor locked phase, the strange quark mass goes down, and so you assumed that it goes.
What did the right feeder look like from that feeder?
Well, Mikhail is saying it correctly, but I'll say it's all we did is in the left figure, MS, I don't remember the numbers anymore, but MS is the same in 2SC and CFL. And in the right figure, the strange quark mass is less in the CFL phase than in the 2SC phase, which is what these folks find. And we made an extremely, they found, we made a change in the strange quark mass, which is much smaller than what they actually find. We made a small difference in the MS.
And it
splits the points in such a way as to make the 2SC phase unfavorable.
So naively, of course, you first might think that the heavier the strange quark mass is, the more favored would be the 2SC. This was the old argument. But of course, if you have heavy strange quark masses, this means, in this case, that they are less populated, so they help less with the charge neutrality. So the splitting of the up and down again becomes larger, and obviously this one wins.
Right. This is exactly our point, and the weakness of our calculation, in addition to the fact that we did the Taylor expansion, is that we are still treating MS as a parameter, whereas really MS is something that needs to be solved for self-consistently along with everything else, the way you guys do.
Yeah.
I mean, your style of calculation, once you've done it, will supersede what we do.
Yes, and in fact, I mean, we started the calculation of the type she has shown, but now for different chemical potentials. So we have set up the basic formulas for that, but now this needs to be solved for beta equilibrated and charge neutral matter. And so we have a student working on this, and we will see what comes out. So there is already one first result which we obtained with this program. And actually, this is what we discussed yesterday at lunch. And this is there was a paper by Raja Gopal and Wilczek claiming that the color flavor locked phase by itself is already charge neutral because no, it turns out to be wrong. And actually, for zero mass, yeah, okay. But even for non-zero mass, if you have different chemical potential, somehow the argument was that the Fermi surfaces are locked in such a way that the densities come out the same in the end. And okay, so we have now our formulas with different chemical potentials for up, down, and strange quark masses. So we can, of course, now take the derivative of our formulas and calculate the densities of up, down, and strange explicitly. And this we have done. So we calculated now these derivatives in order to get the densities. But then we went back to the point that all the chemical potentials are the same. So we took our old results for the gap equation, which Michaela has shown, but calculate now these densities. And what is plotted here is now, so these are densities, I think in terms of nuclear matter densities or whatsoever, doesn't matter, is a function of mu. And now this was, which used to be a green curve, I think, so this lighter curve corresponds now to the density of up quarks and down quarks, which is the same in this case. And this curve is the density of strange quarks. And so we have here, in this case, something. So again, here we have the 2SC phase. And there the density of strange quarks is zero for a very long time. And okay, we have seen in a previous plot that at some point it is not zero anymore. But first of all, this is a different parameter set. And second, I think it is non-zero somewhere here, but you don't see it on the plot. And then it jumps to this value. And so you see it becomes very similar to the density of up and down quarks, but not exactly equal. And in order to judge what I mean by very similar, here I plotted something which is the naive way of doing, that you simply, so you don't correctly calculate the densities by taking the derivative of the thermodynamic potential, but you start just from the chemical potentials which you have, and you take the masses which you have, neglect or gap or pairing, and just take treat it as a free Fermi gas. So you calculate the densities in this way. And if you do that, then the difference would look much larger. So the difference has become reduced in this way, but it is not exactly zero.
And I make the same comment I made at lunch.
Yeah, sure.
Which is that, I think what the correct conclusion from what Frank and I did in that paper, which is not fair, well, it's not stated at all in the paper, but with hindsight, the correct conclusion from that paper is that the CFL phase should be Q tilde neutral, where Q tilde is the linear combination of charges which corresponds to an unbroken gauge symmetry in the CFL phase. And it's a linear combination of electric charge and color charges. So I think when you do the correct...
That is always true because
right,
the point photon automatical rotates a polymer to induce. That's why you can make more.
Well, the...
That is true.
Right, and that's what you should find is that that when you impose, it's not an empty statement because you could impose neutrality by it might be that you needed some electrons to impose that neutrality. And the statement is that in the CFL phase, even with strange quark mass non-zero, you get Q tilde neutrality with no electrons present. That's the statement.
Okay, and in fact, you made this.
That's something which you should be able to check.
Yeah. And you also made a second statement, which we also could check easily, I think. That was.
That was always the truth, because otherwise, this photon, remote photon, is not remote mass. That is necessary for Q to survive.
Well,
so this is not the ordinary neutrality. This is a new neutrality.
I'm glad that by now it's so obvious that everyone, that people say it's obvious. It wasn't obvious at the time.
Well, it is the same that electric theory vacuum is neutral according to a rotated photon.
But these statements are related. You have that quorum because it's neutral, and it's neutral because you have a quorum. But maybe both of the statements would be wrong.
Yeah,
then quorum is not monstrous.
Right.
Well,
if quorum is not monstrous.
It's not that obvious, I guess.
Anyway, I think it's right, so it's a matter of taste whether it's obvious or not.
But it's not neutrality in the ordinary sense, because from outside observer, it has the old photon.
Yeah. The old superconductor photon is not monstrous. It's neutral, it's not
dependent. So I mean, if we go back to a neutron star, then we should correct for this. So the second statement you made at lunch is that if you really look at the color flavor structure of this thing, then so you have three flavors and three colors. So this is some 9x9 matrix, and you find that there are several blocks which correspond to say UD pairing and US pairing and DS pairing. And if you look separately to the contributions of each block, then at least Krishna says that in each block, the two guys which pair have the same density. So again, the Fermi surfaces are somehow.
This is too technical for the rest of the crowd.
Anyway, we can check. Okay, so I think then I'm finished with my part, and okay, the time is running.
Igor.
On the same day that we submitted this paper with Paul Ellis, there was this press conference about the discovery of presumably quark stars. So that was kind of very nice coincidence. And in fact, we were thinking about quark stars, not really quark stars, but basically stars which have quark cores, which seems to be more conservative than bad quark stars. There was quite a few words said about the different phases, and I wouldn't like to repeat many of those things, but I do need to mention a couple of the things. So I'm going to talk about the CFL phase, which seems to be now the most likely candidate for the quark phase, which may exist in quark stars. And basically, there are many different things that I could mention about this, but basically the only key property that I really need is that there is a broken global symmetry in this phase, which is baryon number symmetry. And this plays a crucial role for the discussion that I'm going to present here. There are also some pseudo-Nambu Goldstone bosons. In the Kara limit, you would get many more Nambu Goldstone bosons, which are related to the breaking of the chiral symmetry, basically, and to the approximate axial U1 symmetry. But even the chiral limit, one of them is truly pseudo-Nambu Goldstone boson, and the others get masses as soon as we introduce the masses of the quarks. Oh, sorry, I believe I took, there is, H shouldn't be here. Unfortunately, I took the wrong transparency. I didn't correct this. H is actually the Nambu Goldstone boson related to this U1 baryon, and it shouldn't be in this list.
Don't worry, we don't see
it. Yeah, and actually, that's because I used this wrong transparency. From now on, I'm going to use phi notation for this Nambu Goldstone boson.
I also want to comment that it is, of course, correct papers on step out that if you have no psi bar psi, then you get this quadratic in masses.
Right.
But of course, we still have some
several times. Right. So actually, this was the case when you would get asymptotically large chemical potentials, when the masses are masses of the quarks much less than the chemical potential, you would get this asymptotic formula. This was corrected even in the asymptotic limit when you get, well, not really asymptotic, but large chemical potential, but the hierarchy between the strange and the light quarks is large. But that is not the point.
When you put instanton effects, you can
give
everybody a mass, which is
right. Yes, yeah. That would be like standard mass in ordinary chiral Lagrangian. Yeah, I understand that too. But actually, that wasn't my main point. My main point was that we do get one real Nambu Goldstone boson, which doesn't have any mass, and a bunch of pseudo-Nambu Goldstone bosons, which do have some mass. And the low energy dynamics, which would be defined by the scale of the lightest pseudo-Nambu Goldstone boson, is the scale that we are fixing and considering the dynamics below that scale. Typically, this pseudo-Nambu Goldstone bosons would get masses of water, say, the lightest of them would get the mass of water, say 5 to 10 MeV, and the scales of water 1 MeV would be considered the scales that are considered in this discussion.
A little bigger.
Yeah, I did it myself. Yes, Mathematica, which is very easy, just a couple of sentences. So. I'm going to talk about a compact star with a quark core. Usually it's assumed that this type of stars would appear as an aftermath of supernova explosion. Basically, at first you would get some very large mass which runs out of fuel, and then it collapses. In the end, a lot of stuff runs away, is exploded and blown off into the space, but something is left behind, and that something could be a neutron star or any kind of compact star. And our assumption here is that we could create a star with high enough densities in the central region of this star, which would be in the quark phase. There is a lot of physics just in the process of going from here to here, and it's abbreviated basically in two lines. Here we get some very interesting phenomena like neutrino trapping, and when you have this collapse, a lot of neutrinos are trapped. They have very small Minkfree path. They cannot escape right away from this star. So due to diffusion, they slowly move through this star, heat up, this star on in this process, and eventually we end up with the initial stage that I am starting from and considering further.
Which is at around 1 second.
Right, actually this is very fast process. And even more than that, I'm going even further from that, from this temperatures, say water, dozens of MeV down to this scale that I'm interested in, which I would denote T tilde, the scale where most of the number Goldstone, pseudo number Goldstone bosons decoupled from the low energy dynamics, and we are left essentially only with one single massless number Goldstone boson. And from that point on, I will be basically considering the physics. It is also interesting to mention that basically this process going from 40 down to 1 MeV in typical neutron stars would be also extremely fast, from say minutes up to maybe one day. And this is also interesting part, but basically some other people were considering this region in detail, and I do not want to repeat that. So now we end up with this type of the star with the color flavor log core here, and we want to consider the effect of the cool the effect of the presence of this core on the cooling rate of the star. It appears that cooling is extremely interesting observation, observable. The temperature of the surface actually of this star is extremely interesting, observable, that a lot of effort is put to measure them in the universe, in the, at least in our vicinity of the universe, and that is extremely interesting issue. Also about the general things, I would like to mention that typically neutron stars or compact stars cool mostly by neutrino emission. This is a volume effect, and it appears to be much more efficient than cooling through the diffusion of photons from the interior to outside and then emitting photons. Neutrino emission usually dominates for, say, a water 10 to the 5th years, and if this mechanism would be absent, then there would be only this diffusion due to photons, and that takes a couple of orders magnitude longer times. So, and after the temperature of the star inside is falling below, say, about a couple of dozens kilo electron volt, from that point on, the photon diffusion may take over and dominate the cooling rate. So we have kind of a pretty long range of time scales in which this neutrino emission usually dominates the cooling. And then people naturally come to the color flavor log phase, calculate neutrino emissivities from the color flavor log phase, and it turns out that these emissivities are extremely suppressed. And this is a simple result of the existence of the gap in the quark spectra. And it was calculated in this paper in its first version, well, actually in both versions, that if the cooling were only due to this neutrino emission from the quark core, it would take about 10 to the 24th years for this core to cool. These are extremely long times. If you compare it to these ones, it's many, many orders of magnitude, and it's really it really sounds horrible number. And the conclusion of the first version.
The poster has negligible amount of heat.
Right, it doesn't have that much heat, that's true. But the emissivity is even much less than that. Basically, the thermal energies go like power of the temperature, and the emissivities are suppressed exponentially. And that's basically the reason for having this. And the conclusion of this first version was that basically this core might stay hot for a very long time without cooling. And this is the point where we realized we couldn't agree with, because there is natural source of draining this thermal energy by thermal conductivity. And even a rough estimate, we didn't even have to do any calculation. Rough estimate, assuming, for example, that the mean free path of the number Goldstone bosons would be of order, say, hundreds, at least at least 100 Fermi, which is incredibly small for the new, number Goldstone bosons, even with those small mean free paths, the cooling time would be of order 10 to the 6 years. Even without any other mechanism, just plugging this mean free path of order 100 Fermi, and you would get a number which is just right. But it appears that even that is not really necessary, because the mean free path appears to be extremely long for the number Goldstone bosons. So I briefly give you some sketch of the derivation of this thermal conductivities. But basically, all this could be summarized in one simple formula that I would finish, I will show you later.
Can it be summarized in one simple sentence, which is that
yes.
A superfluid is a good heat conductor?
Basically, it's not really necessary, but yeah, that's a good thing to say, that basically when we have...
Helium-4,
exactly. I mean, this is one of the properties.
Yes, yes. Actually, this is one thing. The other thing is that you could even forget about superfluidity, even if you have very good reason to argue that the mean free path of the lightest degrees of freedom is very long, then the conductivity would be very high. And for example, if you take simple Fermi liquids, usually they have extremely large conductivities, like metal, for example, because the mean free path of electrons is large. So the physics is the same. It's even better. That's even better. That's the thing. That's even better. And I already said,
as Igor knows, when version one of the paper came out, well, at least one person pointed out to the authors that a superfluid was a good conductor of heat.
Right.
And then now Igor is going to tell us quantitatively how good a conductor.
Yeah, basically, the day before we submitted, or maybe 2 days, a couple of days before we submitted, we also communicated these results to Prakash, Schaefer, and Jay Kumar, and they told us already that Krishna pointed this mistake to them. So,
and V2, they have a V2 outcome.
Right. And in the version 2, they basically came to the same conclusion, that the conductivities are very high. So, but let me proceed with the natural kind of way one could derive these conductivities. This is kind of, for the undergraduates, maybe a discussion, but I thought it was kind of transparent and I would show. We have some kind of Lagrangian density for the pseudo-number Goldstone bosons, where the dots denote some kind of interaction. Typically, these are some kind of derivative interactions suppressed by the decay constant 1 over the chemical potential. The corresponding heat current would be defined in the following way, and then the conductivity itself would be given in terms of the correlator of this heat current. So this is the standard. Or you could also write it in terms of the imaginary part of that correlator. So having the rotational symmetry in the system, it's obvious that basically the whole tensor of heat conductivity is characterized by a scalar quantity. And in the case of the small temperatures, as I said, we are going below the temperatures of the lightest pseudo-number Goldstone boson, we get an exponentially suppressed expression for the conductivity. However, in this calculation, we cheated a little bit. We took a phenomenological parameter, decay width, into this calculation, and it was introduced in the propagator as some kind of averaged constant decay width. This is a little bit of cheating, but as I discuss later, it doesn't really matter for different reasons. So this makes it obvious, as soon as the mean free path, which is inverse of this gamma, is not exponentially large, and that could be justified, this conductivity of pseudo-number Goldstone bosons would be extremely suppressed, and the only contribution which comes next is the contribution of the massless number Goldstone bosons related to the baryon number symmetry. So we get this kind of expression.
The ordinary point, right?
Yes, actually, that's a good point, because this number Goldstone bosons is very much like phonon in a crystal, and in fact, some physics that we encounter here.
It's like the second, what they call second sound in helium.
Yes, but actually I like the analogy with the phonon for a different reason, which I would come a little bit later. Because some of the this is the same expression as people use in solid state physics for describing a very low temperature conductivity of phonons. That is also true. And I forgot to mention that basically, without deriving,
when you say phonons, you just mean sound waves.
Sound waves.
Not the phonons of a crystal not the things that are special to having a periodic crystal array. No. Just sound waves.
Actually, this formula is even more popular in some alloys which do not have very good crystal structure, and it would be similar in liquids as well. Basically, it's just sound waves. Yeah, it's more general, and it's better to say sound waves. And we didn't even have to do all this calculation, but jump onto the classical relation for the conductivity, for the relation between the conductivity and the specific heat, since the specific heat is easy to calculate for the massless particles. And then estimating this mean free path, as I said, of what is 100 Fermi already gives you some incredibly large number value for the...
Jai Kumar and company had a calculation of the specific heat, right?
Yes, with a mistake though. If you...
is their specific heat right? That's what I was going to ask.
They had a specific heat expression, but it's something like this. I don't remember exactly. The coefficients say something of this kind. Actually, they wrote pi squared in numerator for some reason.
That's typographical.
It was typographical, okay, yeah. But basically, it's simple expression,
so
something like that.
If they had taken, forget the typos. If they had taken their specific heat and calculated the thermal conductivity like this,
right?
They would have got.
They would get the answer which slightly underestimates the. Conductivity,
yeah.
But essentially it would be more than enough.
Yeah.
So instead of talking in terms of the decay width, it's much more convenient and actually even physically more transparent to talk in terms of the mean free path. And basically it's easy to trade one for the other, where V is the average thermal velocity, which would be the same for the massless particles, but it's different for the massive particles. And there are different sources to this mean free path. One of them is that Nambu-Goldstein boson is a composite particle and it could decay into the pair of quarks. And actually, this calculation was done for the estimate for this decay width was calculated in this paper, and it appears to be, as you would expect, exponentially suppressed. I've heard a couple of questions once in a while that where this three half comes from, and it's essentially due to the finite velocity of the Nambu-Goldstein boson, which is not one but one third. V squared is one third, and that's basically what gives this three half. And then the mean free path would be typically of order inverse decay width, where I replace the momentum by a typical momentum of order temperature, and it becomes something like this, which numerically gives the mean free path of order 30 kilometers or even more. Yes. You're coming to this point, but basically, actually, this dominates at all at some in some window of temperatures below this, say, temperature of order 1 MeV. For 1 MeV here, for example, we took temperature less than delta over 33, so it's say less than what 1 point something MeV. And this mean free path larger than 30 kilometers. When you decrease temperature, it increases even further and becomes huge number. And it's actually very much similar to the physics in super fluid helium, where you have phonons scattered on rotons, and basically this would be something like a mass of the roton, and it behaves very similarly.
The star is only 3 kilometers.
Right. And this is a very good point, and I would use that later. And then also there is scattering of number Goldstone bosons themselves, and that amplitude, in the first version we actually had it different. We took it from this paper, J. Kumar, Prakash, and Schaefer. It was mu squared, delta squared, which they got from somewhere we didn't check. And then recently a paper by Son appeared. He derived this amplitude, and it appears to be k to the fourth divided by mu to the fourth. And then the cross-section, corresponding cross-section, would scale somewhat like t to the sixth, where I took this from dimensional arguments and estimated the mean free path, which would be even much larger than the previous one. So it becomes incredibly large. And when you decrease temperatures, in both cases, they get even larger. This would become much larger at some point, but basically it's not of real interest anymore because all the distances are much larger than a typical size of the star water, say 10 kilometers. And I would come to that a little later, but I should mention that there is a physics behind this thermal conductivity, which is very similar to the physics which happens in very pure crystals. It appears that in very nice crystals at very low temperatures, you could actually reach this regime when the mean free path becomes much larger than the size of the sample. And in those cases, it's natural to assume that the mean free path is actually restricted by the scattering of the phonons on the boundaries. And assuming this mean free path, you could plug it in into the expression for the conductivity and calculate how it behaves with the temperature, and it was actually measured. And it indeed behaves so as if the mean free path is not like much, much larger, but the size of the sample, roughly speaking.
We had a guy who gave a colloquial question, I don't remember the name, which was extremely beautiful. Give you artificial diamond, which is like a disc, millimeter thick, and the mean free path is about 4 millimeters. So you take it in your fingers and you cut ice. And it cut ice like a knife, cut butter, because it smells for a heat from your fingers to ice. And what is the next thing is if you have a C14 and mixture, some percents, a little dirt that restricts it, and it doesn't.
I see.
So you feel by your fingers.
Right.
When you see for two, there is there.
Yeah, actually, that's another thing which I wanted to mention. At room temperature, diamond has the highest value of ever measured conductivity, heat conductivity.
At room temperature.
At room temperature. I mean, actually, it reaches maximum at about, I don't know, something like 200 Kelvin. But basically, this is the highest value ever measured at room temperatures in any samples, and it's a diamond. And in a sense, this CFL phase, as was in news update, it's like the diamond as big as the Ritz, and this conductivity kind of supports the same analogy.
I'll tell the author of that remark.
Yeah, I kind of like this.
But so the lesson of this is that the conduct. If I want to know on what time scale does the core stay at the same temperature as
that's I'm coming in the next. But before that, I have to mention one other component which appears to be relevant is the photon contribution.
So if this was if this transparency didn't exist, then the answer would just be that it's the time scale is the size of the system divided by the speed of sound.
Basically, exactly. And it appears to be less than microsecond.
Yeah.
Actually, I have that estimate on the next transparency. But there is another candidate for the thermodynamics and kinetic properties is photons. And basically, just don't read below this point, photons have also very large mean free path, and it's also much larger than the typical size of the star at these temperatures. This is the characteristic scale of the temperatures I'm considering, and this was already recognized in the paper by J. Kumar, Prakash, and Schaefer. And also they estimated that the photon emission is strongly suppressed, again exponentially suppressed. And at this point you would come to a conclusion that maybe there are no photons left in the quark core at all. Basically because this stuff is completely transparent, the Minkh free pass of photons is very large, and they could simply just all leave this star and go away into the vacuum. It doesn't really matter, because as soon as we have some distribution of the photons, they actually leave the star almost immediately, and new photons are never produced because their emission rates are very suppressed. This is not an infinite system. That's the point. This is not the infinite system. We cannot have equilibrium, complete equilibrium with the photons in a finite size system. That's the statement.
Okay, that's just the mean free path is bigger than the system.
Much bigger than the size of the star. And they would naturally leave the system.
It's keeping getting hit by photons from the outside. The nuclear stuff is going to be pumping
Wait a second.
It's a diamond in a warm blanket.
That's the thing, the next thing. But basically, if this were a bare CFO star, it would all these photons would completely leave the system, and you wouldn't have any of them left. But that's the next point, that basically that may happen only when there is no anything surrounding this quark core. But there is nuclear matter layers outside. And it appears to be that this is not just blanket, it also a very good plasma.
Sure.
Even with the number of the electrons 0.1, which is a typical for many models, the electrons give you very large plasma frequency at this temperature. Well, actually temperature is irrelevant here. And many photons would be just reflected if the system tries to go out of thermal equilibrium. Basically, we have kind of like the experiment that usually described for students of the blackboard radiation. All this is kept inside at some temperature, blackbody temperature.
What about the rest and a little bit of electrons?
Actually, there are a lot of electrons when the temperature larger than one MeV. Electron positron pairs.
In CFL, there is some little, you know, 1% of electrons.
I mean, non-zero because of the non-zero temperature.
Because of non-zero strange quark mass.
Oh, that. No.
At zero temperature, there is none.
In ideal case, there shouldn't be. If it's not ideal, and maybe they are needed for this, but still, here we are talking about the photons which are rotated photons. So for them, we also don't have any. Yeah, I'm basically finishing. So basically, here the point I wanted to make is that these photons will be trapped; they cannot really escape easily, and that adds another contribution to the thermal conductivity due to photons. Here are these estimates. Well, this statement I already said, that the Minkh free path is restricted only by the size of the star, and then we could calculate the conductivities, plugging in this value of the Minkh free path, and taking the proper velocities of number Goldstone boson and a photon, and we get a huge number for the thermal conductivity, which appears to be many orders of magnitude larger than the conductivity of nuclear matter, which also appears to be extremely large. This value is like, I don't know, something like 15 to 20 orders of magnitude larger than the conductivity of this diamond that you were talking about. So this is extremely large, and basically it easily gives you the estimate for the relaxation time, which is less than microsecond. And then the next point I should make, that indeed, as already was mentioned by Edward, that the thermal energy of the CFL phase is relatively small. It's proportional to the power of the temperature. Unlike that, the thermal energy of the nuclear matter, which surrounds in this outer layers of the star, would be much larger, and this is due to the chemical potential for the neutrons. So basically, this number appears to be many orders of magnitude larger than the thermal energy of the star. The high conductivity of the star means that essentially the whole interior of the star would be isothermal. As soon as the temperature of one of the layers goes down a little bit, actually it's this one. If it goes a little bit down due to emissivity of neutrinos, the heat from this core would be transferred to the nuclear matter layer, and the temperature would be again equal. The isothermal state would be preserved by very large heat conductivity. And essentially, because the emissivity of neutrinos is a volume effect, and basically we decrease the volume of the nuclear layer, but we also decrease the thermal energy we have to emit. Essentially, the cooling rates of these quark stars would be almost identical to the cooling rates of ordinary nuclear neutron stars. Just a couple of other things which I would like to mention, just listing them really, that many other kinetic properties could also be estimated using this low energy dynamics, and basically the shear viscosity would be again dominated by the same degrees of freedom. Electrical conductivity, unlike them, would be dominated by the lightest charged Nambu-Goldstone boson, which is K plus usually, and then the electrical conductivity would behave something like this. And well, it's basically the other realization of the neutrality. Basically, as temperature goes down, this exponentially goes to zero. In the phase with two flavors, many kinetic properties would be dominated by the gapless quarks. This is the third color, U and D of the third color, and they would be dominating. And also, if this phase were possible inside the quark star, the thermal conductivity would be again very large, because these are Fermi liquids, nearly Fermi liquids, and the star would be isothermal. And a separate issue, which I also wanted to mention, that maybe if this bare CFL quark stars are possible, so that's basically the stars without this outside nuclear layer. In that case, as I already discussed, they should be photon free. The emissivities are very suppressed. The emissivities of both photons and Nambu-Goldstone bosons are extremely suppressed. However, the Nambu-Goldstone bosons, like phonons in the crystal, they cannot leave the phase which gave birth to them. So they basically would be almost completely scattered at the surface, and that might give some additional emission from the scattering of these Nambu-Goldstone bosons from the surface. And this would be, if that emission rates due to the scattering would be very small, then this would look like very dim stars, and maybe they're very good candidates for the dark matter. So this is the conclusions, and I guess I ran out of time, so I wouldn't read this. Maybe you could leave out the first one. Yeah.
Is there any astronomical signal to distinguish a Newton star from a quark star?
Well, that's basically this thing, that more work is needed, because
The pure quark stars cool instantly.
Pure quark stars? No, they don't cool instantly. They are invisible. In fact, they could have some temperature, but the thermal energy is very small, and they do not have any ways of emitting it, this small thermal energy that they keep. They are black. They're transparent, invisible, don't shine, don't do anything.
Well, but they'll have stuff falling onto them, right?
I mean, well, gravitationally, they would be.
Even the interstellar medium. And moving through the interstellar medium, they'll have.
I guess that would give some X-ray radiation, I assume that can be seen.
That's an interesting question for the.
Right, but I'm not sure.
The one on press conference has a measuring temperature, right? It's KV.
Right, it's about like 57 or something
KV. It's a million years old, so it is on a standard line.
Yeah.
So you're saying, although heat conductivity is infinite, but it cannot emit anything from the surface because there are no photons?
There is no mechanism of emitting energy. Photon emission and neutrino emission are very suppressed. Okay. Photon emission is suppressed. Neutrino emission is suppressed. And there is...
Why is photon emission suppressed?
Well, that's the calculation that Prakash and Schaefer did.
But
emission is suppressed.
If there is one centimeter of something else on its surface.
Well, actually, that's true. The details of the boundary interface between the CFL phase and the vacuum is very unclear. First of all, it's unclear if it is possible in principle. And when it is possible, then basically there would be some, I don't know, maybe 10 fermions or something, this interface layer. And what happens there is completely unclear, at least at the moment.
Wait, Prakash and company just said that the specific heat is small. I mean, the only reason it's still going to be radiating photons from its surface, even if...
From the surface, yes.
And then by your argument, it's radiating photons from its surface, and by your argument, it's kept isothermal. So
No. It could radiate something from the surface. Yeah. That I don't really know. I know that there is no volume effect.
Sure, but when photons are never a volume effect.
Yeah.
Photons are always a surface
effect. Right.
Well, stars radiate from surface.
Right. Including these.
Oh, yeah, in that case, you might be right.
I mean, I think the point is, whatever it is saying is correct. It will cool very quickly.
In that case, yes.
It has very little heat in it to start with.
Well, in that case...
Emitting photons from its surface, it will cool very quickly.
Yes, it would cool very quickly in that case.
You said that the cooling was from neutrino emission, most of it's a volume effect.
Well, that wouldn't be due to neutrino emission. That would be due to a photon emission from the surface.
Yeah. Hector,
yeah. There are two different mechanisms.
Most of his talk was not about a quark star. It was about a quark matter lump in the middle of a regular star.
Right.
And for that, the cooling is by neutrino emission from the nuclear mantle. Not from the quark volume, but from the nuclear volume. Yeah.
Yeah, if there is a large emission of photons from the surface, then probably some of these statements actually... this statement may not be quite correct.
That's right, but the point is it's going to cool very quickly.
Well, if it cools quickly.
But the reason it's very dim, I thought you were saying, is that it's cool, it's basically...
The point is that I didn't really estimate the time for that cooling. Because you don't really know the physics at the surface. You don't really know how many photons you could really emit.
But no, Hector, I think the best answer to your question is if that announcement a few weeks ago of a star with a radius of 5 kilometers had turned out to be correct, and the astrophysicists there's now papers saying that it's not correct, but if that had been correct, then the only thing it could be is a quark star. But it's not correct.
But that is a different issue. Basically, it's mostly about the equation of state.
Right.
It's not about the cooling.
Sure.
But there is one statement which says about the cooling that maybe the cooling of one of the stars is not on the track.
The lesson from your talk, which is solid, is that if you want to know whether there's a quark matter core, if you want to know if there's a CFL core, cooling won't tell you.
Actually, even ordinary quark core seems to be doesn't tell you anything.
Because the cooling rate will be dominated completely by the nuclear physics and the nuclear mantle. The core is sitting there inert. It doesn't emit, it doesn't have any heat capacity, and it stays at the same temperature as this warm blanket. So it basically doesn't perturb the system. The quark matter
it kind of like drops off dynamics of cooling.
For this particular star, by the way, if you remember they have seen quite a lot, they measure heat position, so they know velocity vector, and they also see even some traces of this wake.
Right,
wake.
Yeah.
And in the direction of that velocity, there is a nebula which is 1 million year old, so they know that it is a million year old star, and it has temperature on TV.
Right.
So.
Well, actually, I'm not sure about the other mechanism, but I believe I know some very natural mechanism of having a hot spot on this kind of stars.
By accretion?
No. By energy from inside.
But there is no energy inside.
Well, there is no much. Yeah, that's true. I mean, if the quark core is really large.
Oh, sorry. You mean a star with a quark core, not a quark star. Well, let's let's applaud all three discussers and